Good morning. Good morning. So today we're beginning a discussion of the third sort of basic epidemiologic observational study design, case control studies. Instead of taking 3 days this week to talk about them, we're going to take today and Wednesday, and on Friday I've decided to spend a little time telling you about swine flu and then try and get your help with some studies I'm trying to design at the moment to help better understand swine flu vaccine and its adverse and beneficial effects. So maybe you can help me since I'm having lots of problems. So that we're going to slightly change things on Friday. But it'll still basically be coming down to case control studies. So as it says here, the synonym for case control studies, sometimes they're referred to as case reference studies. I suspect you'll have a hard time finding anyone who calls them case reference studies. But people like to generate new terminology that they think is better, and frequently it falls by the wayside. And I would say that this is terminology which has largely fallen by the wayside. So most people refer to these as case control studies. And as it says here, case control studies are observational studies in which people with the health outcome of interest, cancer, high blood pressure, whatever it is, are compared with individuals without the disease or health outcome who are called controls. With regard to various attributes, particularly exposures, various risk factors. So again, in these studies, unlike cohort studies where we start out knowing who's exposed and look to see who develops disease, or cross-sectional studies where we determine the outcome and exposure status at exactly the same point in time, in case control studies, the investigator starts out knowing who's a case and who's a control, and then looking, if you will, backward at the exposures they had in the past. Okay? So one of the problems, as I'll point out a little bit on Wednesday, is sometimes in cohort studies, people like to refer to the people who are exposed and people who are control subjects, such as HIV-infected people and non-HIV-infected people, and then follow those two groups over time to see what happens to them. And not surprisingly, when they think about those unexposed people as, quote, controls, unquote, they frequently get confused and call those studies case control studies. And I'll show you an example on Wednesday of a grant review I just did in which reasonable epidemiologists apparently got confused about what type of study they were doing. So if you can keep in mind that you need to begin to think first, what's the exposure? What's the outcome? Which do you know first? Then you should have no trouble keeping this straight, although seemingly a lot of people do have trouble keeping it straight. So again, the basic notion is here we are in the present. There are people with the disease, such as lung cancer. We find the people with the illness we're interested in, typically because in case control studies, the diseases we're studying are rare. We're frequently interested in taking all of the cases, but in theory, you could take a sample of the cases. And we then take a sample of people without the disease, and we refer to them as controls. So now we start out knowing who's a case and who's a control, and we go and ascertain in the past what their various exposures were. Okay. So the old perspective, and you can look at older textbooks and see that they typically refer to case control studies as backwards studies. In fact, somebody once got the clever idea of calling case control studies TROHUC studies. Why did they want to call them TROHUC studies? Because TROHUC is cohort spelled backwards. Okay, that's something that really didn't catch on, but you can see it referred to in some places. So the old notion is that case control studies are backwards studies, okay, in which you start out with the outcome status and then look backward at the exposure status. That's a very old-fashioned way of thinking about case-control studies. And the more modern approach, and if you take 250B, you'll learn a great deal about this, is that case-control studies are an efficient sampling technique for measuring exposure-disease associations in a cohort or a study base. In theory, every case-control study takes place within a cohort, even though that cohort may in practice be difficult or impossible to characterize. So if, for example, we were finding all of the cases of lung cancer in the state of California and putting them into a case control study, we would say that all of those cases came from the cohort of individuals living in California. Okay? So in that sense, all case control studies occur within a cohort. Sometimes we know exactly who the cohort is and can define that cohort. Sometimes it's a little squishy. And so the basic notion here is that in case control studies, we're sampling the population of those without the disease. We call those people controls. Okay, so going back to a 2x2 table, to remind you about 2x2 tables, because those are, a lot of us can't think much beyond the 2x2 table. I can't, for example. Here you can see we've divided the world into people who have the exposure, yes and no. They have the disease outcome, yes and no. And so if this was a cohort study, if we started out with people in the exposed and unexposed group, and we followed them over time, we could calculate something like the cumulative incidence, A over A plus B, in the exposed, and in the unexposed, C over C plus D, and we could calculate a risk ratio, right? The risk in the exposed divided by the risk in the unexposed. So that's what's shown here, the risk ratio, A over A plus B over C over C plus D. But in this same table, you can calculate two types of odds ratios, the exposure odds ratio and the disease odds ratio. Okay, so what do I mean by those? So in this case, the disease odds ratio is the odds of disease among the exposed divided by the odds of disease among the unexposed. And so that's just A over B divided by C over D. Okay, the odds of disease among the exposed over the odds of disease among the unexposed is the disease odds ratio, and A over B divided by C over D ends up being A times D over B times C, which ends up being AD divided by BC. That doesn't take a lot of fancy mathematics, right? Okay. Similarly, you can define the exposure odds ratio, and the exposure odds ratio, going back to this table, is just A over C divided by B over D. And so A over C divided by B over D is A times D over C times B, which also turns out, fortunately, to be AD over BC. So the exposure odds ratio and the disease odds ratio turn out to be the same thing in this 2x2 table. Okay? So the odds ratio from that table is A times D divided by B times C. And although we're going to come back to this issue of what's called sometimes called the rare disease assumption, What you can figure out is that in a cohort, as the outcomes becomes very rare, as A over A plus, as A becomes very, very rare, A over A plus B is pretty close to A over B. C over C plus D is pretty close to C over D. So within that cohort, the risk ratio begins to approximate the odds ratio when the risk of disease is very small. Okay? Now I'm going to talk Wednesday about why you don't even need this rare disease assumption for the odds ratio to be a reasonable approximation of the risk ratio. But the initial formulation of case control studies relied on that. And so the way of thinking about this is, if you were to take that die we rolled, the 1 in 6, the risk of rolling a 6, for example, is 1 in 6. The odds is 1 to 5, so the risk and the odds, one out of 6, compared to 1 to 5. If there are 100 equal outcomes, the risk or the probability is 1 in 100. The odds is 1 to 99. And you can basically see as this risk gets smaller and smaller, the risk ratio and the odds ratio, in fact, become very similar to each other. So what does that mean? Let me show you a hypothetical example and then show you some real data. So suppose we had a population of 1 million people, and those 1 million people were comprised of 400,000 smokers and 600,000 non-smokers. And that 1% of smokers get cancer and 0.1% of non-smokers get cancer. So within that cohort, pretty simple to do the arithmetic, okay? The cumulative incidence of 1% would yield 4,000 getting cancer, 396,000 without cancer. The cumulative incidence of 0.1% here would yield 600 with cancer, 599,400 without cancer. And not surprisingly, if you calculate the risk ratio, you'll come up with exactly 10, because in fact, as I made up at the beginning, the risk in the exposed is 10 times the risk in the unexposed, right? So in this artificial cohort, the risk ratio is 10, right? Everybody clear on that? Okay. So and if you were to do the cohort study, this is how many cases you'd find, how many cases you'd find in the smokers, how many you'd find in the non-smokers, and so you could calculate that risk ratio, but you could also calculate an odds ratio. And if you calculate the odds ratio for the whole population, and you can calculate an odds ratio in a cohort study, nothing wrong with calculating an odds ratio in a cohort study, you'll see it's A times D divided by B times C, and the odds ratio here turns out to be 10.09, or very, very similar to, just a little bit higher than the risk ratio of 10. Okay? So in this population, the risk ratio for cancer among smokers compared to non-smokers is 10. The odds ratio in this whole population is 10.09. Okay? But suppose it's really difficult to study a million people and follow them over time. We could do a case control study in which we have to study far fewer people. Okay? So suppose that we do a case control study within this population of a million people. So instead of studying all million people, we sit around and we wait for people to get their cancer. So altogether, 1% of the 400,000 smokers get cancer. So there are 4,000 cancers among smokers. There are 600 cancers among non-smokers. So in this whole population at the end of the day, there are 4,600 people who got cancer, right? This is all just simple arithmetic, okay? And of those cases, 600 out of 4,600 were non-smokers. So 13% were non-smokers, 4,000 over 4,600 were smokers, or 87% were smokers, right? So that's what this whole cohort is comprised of, smokers and non-smokers getting cancer. And 13% of the cases would be non-smokers, 87% would be smokers. Okay. Now, if I do a case control study, and I am not biased, and we're going to come back and talk about selection bias later in the semester, but if I select an unbiased sample of cases and an unbiased sample of controls, in doing a case control study, let's see what odds ratio I would come up with. Okay? So, in fact, the odds ratio should be equal to the odds ratio in the entire population, except for some rounding error. So, among the people who didn't get cancer, there are 995,400 people who didn't get cancer, right? They're eligible to be controls. Of those people, there are this many smokers and this many non-smokers. So among the controls, people eligible to be controls, 40% are smokers, 60% are non-smokers. So suppose I do a case control study in which I choose 100 cases, a representative sample of 100 cases, and a representative sample of 100 non-cases, okay? If I did that, and there was no bias, so then I'd end up with 87% of the cancer patients would be smokers, and 13% would not be. 40% of the controls would be smokers, and 60% would not be. And I could calculate that odds ratio, not studying a million people, but studying how many people? 200 people, 100 cases, and 100 controls. And if I did that, I'd come up with an odds ratio of 10.04, which is pretty close to the odds ratio in the population. Okay? So what this is basically meant to show is if you do an unbiased case control study within a cohort, the odds ratio from the case control study should be very close to the odds ratio in the entire cohort. Okay? So some of you are shaking your heads. You may want to think about it a little bit. But nevertheless, that's what all of this is predicated on. So in case control studies, we cannot calculate risks and risk ratios or rates or rate ratios. That's why I was in the other day talking about the fact that this supposed case control study reported prevalences. You can't calculate prevalence in a case control study. What you can calculate are the exposure and disease odds and the odds ratios. And in fact, you can also calculate the attributable proportion among the exposed and among the population under certain assumptions. Okay? So let's talk for a minute about what would happen if you tried to calculate a risk ratio in a case control study and why that's a really bad idea, because the calculations, while you can do them, are completely meaningless. Okay? So if I gave you this 2x2 table, cancer, smoking, yes, no, yes, no, you in theory could calculate a risk ratio, right? You could take the risk in the exposed, 87 out of 127 who were smokers, 13 out of the non-smokers, 13 out of 73. And if you tried to do that, 87 over 127 over 13 over 73 is equal to 3.8. Okay? Now, I'd first point out to you that 3.8 is nowhere near the risk ratio in this population, which is 10, right? So it's not even close to being right. But the other problem with this is that that risk ratio, that supposed risk ratio you calculated, is entirely dependent on how many controls you choose per case. So in this case control study, somebody arbitrarily decided to study 100 cases and 100 controls. What if they had chosen to study 100 cases and 200 controls? Okay, we'd like the effect measure to be the same no matter how many controls you choose per case. But look what happens if you, instead of taking 100 cases and 100 controls, you took 100 cases and 200 controls with these exact same odds. The odds ratio is still 10.04. All of a sudden, this supposed risk ratio is now 5.2. Again, it's a meaningless calculation. You can look at these numbers. You can do this calculation. But if it's a case control study, do not attempt to calculate a risk ratio because it's a meaningless number. What if you took 1,000 controls and 100 cases? Here you'd come up with some completely other value of this supposed risk ratio. Okay? So you can calculate odds ratios in cohort studies. You can calculate risk ratios in cohort studies. But you cannot calculate risk ratios in case control studies. It doesn't make any sense, however tempting it is to look at those four numbers and try and do it. Okay? So avoid that temptation. Okay, so now let's look at some real case control studies. So this is a case control study of my favorite topic, lung cancer and smoking, to beat this dead horse a little bit more. So in this instance, people said it's really too cumbersome and difficult to follow a cohort of British doctors for the next 50 years. I'm going to do a study of smoking and lung cancer and do a case control study. So you sit in a tumor registry, and what do? You collect all the cases of lung cancer that are diagnosed. They have criteria for what's a case of lung cancer. So they found 1,357 people with histologically confirmed lung cancer. And then they went out and found some people who didn't have lung cancer, and those were their controls. And then what did they do? To test their hypothesis. They ask about their smoking status. Now, obviously, this, in fact, it sounds simple. In fact, it's a little difficult. Why is it a little difficult? So they're starting out knowing who's a case and who's a control. They start out knowing the outcome status. And now they want to go back and determine their exposure status, whether they were smokers or not. Right? So what would you think would be some of the challenges of doing that? So if you're interested in the fine details of how much they smoked for how long, that information might not be as easy to capture as it would be if you were following people prospectively. That's exactly right. What else? Anything else? So maybe the people will report their smoking status with more or less accuracy than we might like, and it might even differ depending on whether they're a case or a control, how accurately they report their exposures. That's something we'll call, when we come back to it, recall bias, where cases and controls differentially recall their exposure status in terms of the accuracy of their recall. What else?
I don't know if this is a problem, but this study would only be limited to those who are
alive. Well, it wouldn't necessarily be limited to those who are alive. We can enroll dead cases. Okay, if we enroll dead cases, then we either have to rely on written records of their exposure, or we need to ask a surviving spouse, family member, child, whatever, and that may introduce more inconsistency and accuracy in the measurement. In fact, that's been well studied. The other interesting question about that is, if you enroll dead cases, should you also enroll dead controls? Okay, and I say that quite seriously because it's an issue that comes up in case control studies. If you're going to include dead cases, should you also include dead controls? And human subjects committees, of course, sometimes get a little twitchy about going to the survivors of people who died, particularly if they don't even have the disease you're studying. Okay, so those would be some of the challenges. But in general, people actually can pretty well reliably remember their smoking history. They do better with smoking and with some other variables. And here the exposure is average number of cigarettes smoked daily in the recent past. So here are the data from this real-life case control study. They had 1,357 people with lung cancer, and of those, 1,350 were smokers and 7 were not smokers. So do non-smokers get lung cancer? Yes, they do, but not nearly as often as smokers. Among the controls who didn't have lung cancer, you can see here, and what's of interest, what can you tell me about this population just looking at these numbers? So if the controls are truly representative of the population from which they came, and that's the hope, okay, and we're going to come back to how do you choose a representative sample of controls, what could you say about this population? An awful lot of people smoke, right? So you could say that if these are controls, you'd say this is an astonishing proportion of people who smoke, right? It's about 95% of the population are smokers, right? Pretty amazing. So this study was in fact done back in the 1950s in a place where smoking was extremely common. Okay, but even in that setting, you can see, so the odds ratio is A times B divided by B times C. Again, you can't calculate a risk ratio here. And you come up with this odds ratio of 9.1. Okay, pretty simple. And in fact, if you have information about the amount they smoked, you can divide people up, in this case, into light smokers, moderate smokers, heavy smokers. And then you can, in fact, calculate an odds ratio for light smoking compared to no smoking, moderate smoking compared to no smoking, heavy smoking compared to no smoking, right? You just have to take the right four numbers from this table to calculate the odds ratio, right? So, in fact, when they did that, they found that light smokers had an odds of lung cancer of about 7, moderate smokers had an odds of around 10, and heavy smokers had an odds ratio of about 16 odds ratios. Okay? So just as we can in a cohort, if you have data about different levels of exposure, you can actually look to see if higher levels of exposure correlate with a greater odds of disease. Right? Pretty simple in concept. Now, again, one of the problems is these words prospective and retrospective. Okay? So I told you before that in one sense all cohort studies are prospective in that we start out knowing people's exposure status. We follow them over time to see who gets the disease. But that we have prospective cohort studies that start today and march into the future. We have retrospective or historical cohort studies that start in the past and march up until today. Similarly, in one sense, all case control studies are retrospective, because in all case control studies, we start out knowing the outcome and look back at the exposure. But people insist on putting adjectives in front of case control study. So when they talk about a prospective case control study, what they mean is, I'm going to start with new cases arising today and continue to collect new cases into the future. Okay? A retrospective case control study, they mean, I'm going to go into the past and take cases that may have occurred last year, 5 years ago, whatever it is, and put them into my study. So if you're not thoroughly confused about the use of these terms, retrospective and prospective, that's good for you, but some of you probably are. So another common adjective for case control studies are matched and unmatched case control studies. So in matched case control studies, which all of you will intuitively have some understanding of, we basically choose the controls by matching them in one or more characteristics to the cases. So what type of characteristic might I want to match on when choosing controls for my cases? Age. Age is the one that people almost invariably gravitate toward. We're going to come back to the advantages and disadvantages of matching. Epidemiologists and others tend to really, really, really want to match in case control studies. Statisticians typically say don't match, and we'll deal with all these variables in the analysis. You're better off not matching, but epidemiologists seem compelled to match, and there are some good reasons for matching. A nested case control study is a case control study, and we'll talk about these a week from today, next Monday, are studies in which the case control study truly occurs within a definable cohort, like the nurse's health study or that healthcare provider's cohort or whatever it is. And everybody in the case control study comes from that particular definable cohort. So that's what we mean by a nested case control study. Case cohort studies are very similar to nested case control studies, except for how you choose who's eligible to be a control, and we'll talk about both of these a week from today. You will also frequently hear about hospital-based case control studies. So hospital-based case control studies, and we're going to talk about this on Friday and all of my problems with my influenza studies, case control studies in which the cases are ascertained based on admission to one or more hospitals. So in order to be found and included as a case, you not only need to have the illness, you need to be hospitalized with the illness, and people who don't get hospitalized have no opportunity to make it into the study. Okay? And then typically in hospital-based case control studies, or at least in one instance, controls are selected from among other individuals hospitalized at the same hospital, although sometimes you can choose the controls from the community. Now, the thing that's worth pointing out here is unless virtually all of the cases of a disease end up being hospitalized, you won't be surprised to know that people get hospitalized for their disease and people who don't may be very, very different people. Right? And in particular, they may be different in terms of the exposures we're interested in, so they can bias, we can have biased estimates. Yes? How do you get the data what? HIPAA. Okay. So we can talk about this on Friday because the studies I do of influenza, or we'll be talking about, are all hospital-based influenza cases. So they're people who are hospitalized with influenza, and if they had influenza diagnosed in the outpatient setting, I'm not interested. So if your basic issue is, are there IRB concerns about this? Sure. Are there HIPAA issues? Yes. Typically, if we're in public health, we can avoid the HIPAA issues to a certain extent because public health basically has an exemption for many, many things under HIPAA. But if you're just an average researcher from the University of California, Berkeley, you don't benefit from those exemptions as much. Okay. So then you have to follow HIPAA guidelines in terms of access to records, and it sort of makes things harder. Okay? So if you take a disease where, in essence, 100% of people are hospitalized, Guillain-Barré syndrome, for example, which we'll talk about on Friday as a possible adverse effect of influenza vaccine, we're pretty certain that almost everybody with Guillain-Barré syndrome gets hospitalized. Okay? Now, we might could be wrong about that, but in that instance, using a hospital-based case control study probably finds us pretty much every single case. We also talk about population-based case control studies. So population-based case control studies are studies in which all of the diagnosed cases, or possibly a representative sample of the cases, that arise in a given geographic area or population are included, whether they're hospitalized, whether they obtain medical care, etc. So a common way to do this would be in the tumor registry. Tumor registries are designated to collect data on everybody with cancer within a particular population, and they're pretty good at finding every single case of lung cancer, breast cancer, whatever it is, okay? Because they've got a lot of money, they have the access, and they pretty much find every case. So you can do true population-based studies in tumor registries, or if there's a birth defects monitoring program, you can do true population-based case control studies of birth defects, et cetera. Okay, so in what situations are case control studies done or are they advantageous? Well, one is I'll show you to study rare diseases in which cohorts simply can't be large enough to give you enough cases to come up with any reasonable estimates of risk or risk ratios. So they're particularly valuable for studying rare diseases. They're useful when the exposure data are difficult or expensive to get. They're useful when the underlying population is dynamic and you really have a hard time knowing so that there's a particular group of people who constitute a cohort. They're very useful in investigating outbreaks. They can be used to assess the effectiveness of vaccines and screening programs as they're used in the real world, and that's what we'll talk about on Friday. And they can be used to study new diseases or diseases of uncertain etiology where you have many, many hypotheses you'd like to test, all in the same study. Okay? So we'll go through some of these examples. I don't know if we'll get to all of them today. Otherwise, we'll finish up with them on Wednesday. So this is an example of a rare disease in which a case control study was very useful. So this disease is adenocarcinoma of the vagina, which is an extremely rare cancer. Okay? You're talking about a cancer of about 1 in 1 million people. So could you possibly do a cohort study in which you assembled millions of women and follow them over time to see who gets this cancer? Pretty unlikely. Pretty difficult to imagine, okay? So between 1966 and 1969, in one hospital, a referral hospital in Boston, there were 7 cases seen among these very young women in whom the disease almost never occurs. And then there was an 8th case at a nearby hospital. So they were interested in doing a case control study to look at exposures that these eight cases may have had that differentiate them from women who don't have this very rare cancer. Okay? So they basically get permission to enroll these eight women in their case control study. There were a number of things that didn't appear to be any different about them, so they focused on one particular exposure. But here you can see they've got eight cases with histologically confirmed cancer of the vagina. They chose four controls per case. So how many people are in this study altogether? How many women do they need to collect data on? 40. Eight cases, four times eight, 32 controls, a total of 40 women. So you can begin to get a sense of the efficiency of these studies. Instead of studying millions of women, they're going to study 40 women. Okay? They selected women born within 5 days of the case and in the same hospital on the same service, so they had to go back into the hospital records. These were women in their 20s, so 20 years ago, who was born in the same hospital. Choose those women and try and track them down and get them to be controls. Okay? There were no differences between cases and controls in maternal age, maternal smoking, breastfeeding, intrauterine x-ray exposure, or many other exposures. And only one exposure turned out to be significant, and that was in utero exposure to diethylstilbestrol. Okay? So what's diethylstilbestrol? So while you think about what that is, just to point out that among the eight cases, seven had this exposure. Among the 32 controls, none of them had been exposed in utero. And of course, when there's a zero on the table, A times D divided by B times C, you can't calculate because of the zero. Okay? So in fact, it's infinite, but there's a significant p-value here. And there are tricks. You can add a half to this cell and then make a calculation. But fundamentally, you can't make a calculation of an odds ratio with a zero on the table. Okay? And so what's diethylstilbestrol? Diethylstilbestrol is it? Yeah?
Was it not given to women before they were giving birth as like a prenatal vitamin almost?
It was basically considered something really good for pregnancy to help women who might, it was initially started out, it's an estrogen-like hormone, and it was thought that it could help women who were at risk of miscarriage maintain their pregnancy. So it became fairly commonly used in the 1940s and 50s for healthier pregnancies. Okay, and this study pretty much confirmed what we now know to be quite true, which was that exposure to this in utero for a female child basically was responsible for these cases of cancer of the vagina 25 to 30 years later, in addition, in fact, to a host of other maladies. And in fact, boys in utero with exposure also have some adverse effects, and it's beginning to look like the grandchildren actually may also have some adverse effects from this in utero exposure, although I'm not sure I understand the biology. And one of our doctoral students a number of years ago was a woman who was one of the lucky survivors, because most of these women actually died of their cancer. She underwent massive surgery and did survive, but not the kind of surgery you'd like to undergo. So a simple example of a very rare cancer where the case control study, just looking at 40 women, was in fact quite useful in identifying, if you will, the cause of that cancer. Okay. Now here's another example of studying a new disease where there are lots of hypotheses. So we've talked a little bit about this disease, toxic shock syndrome, and I mentioned to you that when people first investigated this, most of the cases, but not all of them, occurred in women, and most of the cases in women occurred during menstruation. So the question was, why was that? And a number of people did case control studies of this. So you can see the state of Wisconsin Health Department found 35 cases. They enrolled three controls per case. At CDC, we had 52 cases and 52 controls. And we tested many, many hypotheses, but the only ones that were statistically significant were tampon use and non-use of contraception. Okay? So this looks at some of the things that were not found to be associated in that case control study. And you can begin to get a sense that you can test many, many hypotheses in a case control study. Whatever goofball hypothesis you come up with, if you can collect information about that exposure from the cases and the controls in a relatively reliable way, then you can test all of those hypotheses. Okay? You're not limited to one. You can test dozens of hypotheses. Okay, so you can see people had lots of interesting hypotheses, and none of these turned out to be relevant. And in fact, you can see that in these studies, for example, did not find that frequency of changing tampons was associated with the risk, despite what your package insert and label mandated by the FDA tells you. Now, simply to point out, and we're going to come back to this issue, how do you choose controls for a study? What are the possible sources of controls? We'll come back to that. This was a study we subsequently did with 108 women with toxic shock syndrome. This disease occurred about 1 in 10,000 women at that time. So too rare to do cohort studies, a natural target for a case control study. And in this instance, we actually chose two types of controls, friends and neighborhood match controls based on random digit dialing. We'll come back to the pros and cons of different control groups in a little bit. And you can see basically there was an odds ratio for use of tampons of around 28. And because we could also calculate the in vitro absorbency of the different tampons women used, we could actually calculate the increase in odds, the odds ratio per gram increase in tampon absorbency, and show that basically there was a linear relationship. The more and more absorbent the tampons were that women used, the greater their odds of toxic shock syndrome. Okay? Because once you can actually measure these things in vitro in the laboratory. Right? So in essence, here, the exposure of interest is a continuous variable. It's tampon absorbency, the amount of number of grams of liquid that a tampon can absorb. Okay, a continuous variable. And you can give the odds per gram, in this case, increase. Well, interestingly, if you just look at all the case control studies done of that disease, you can see quite an interesting array of how people decided to choose controls. They chose clinic controls. They chose friends. They chose neighborhood matched controls. They did male surveys of nationally representative samples of households. So we're going to come back to this issue, but a key question in case control studies is, what's the right control group? Or what's a plausible control group? Because part of this has to do with an unbiased group of controls, and the other has to do with what's feasible in the real world. Okay? And controls, which we'll come back to, controls are meant to be representative of the population from which the cases originated. Okay? It's easy to say, it's in fact challenging to do. Okay, here's an example of a case control study to study outbreaks. I showed you before that luau with the salmonella and the rice ball being the cause, and people did an historical cohort study. But you can also do case control studies, and that's in fact what's more commonly done in outbreaks. So here you can see in Sierra Leone in West Africa, 18 children and 9 adults presented with sudden onset of weakness, dizziness, vomiting, and diarrhea within 30 minutes of eating. Severely affected, frothed at the mouth, became short of breath and lost consciousness. 7 of 27 died within a few hours. So if you had to guess what kind of foodborne outbreak, if you assume it's a food, what would be at the top of your list of things that might be causing this outbreak based on that little bit of information? Pardon? Louder. Botulism, no. Botulism, first of all, takes much longer to have its onset, and secondly, the symptoms actually look somewhat different from this. Bacillus cereus, and when it produces a toxin, so like Staph aureus, takes at least generally a number of hours, so not very likely that be serious either.
Ricin?
Okay, well, more generally, I don't know much about ricin and what it does, but more generally, a chemical. Okay, for something to have this quick an onset, it's got to be a very toxic substance in which you basically get sick very, very soon after ingesting it. So it makes it much more likely that it's a preformed toxin, and in fact, most likely a man-made toxin rather than a natural toxin. Okay, something similar happened in a village nearby, and so you can see this was quite a serious outbreak. So they had to come up with a case definition to decide who's a case. And then for controls in this, they selected alphabetically from households of the patients. So in other words, if you were sick, they chose somebody else from your household to be a control. And then what did they ask about? What were the exposures they were interested in? What did you eat? Okay, what were your various food exposures? Okay. So foods and beverages consumed during the 4 hours prior to onset in the cases or on the day the patient became ill. They had a list of commonly used foods and beverages in this part of Sierra Leone. And so here are the results from this case control study for consuming bread, one of the food items. And you can see that there was an odds of getting this illness of around 13 associated with eating bread. Okay? So just go back to this for a second. So this, in fact, was an outbreak of a pesticide. And the pesticide basically had been transported by truck. And the large barrels of pesticide on the truck were right next to sacks of flour. Some of the pesticide spilled into the flour. The flour was used to bake the bread. This is parathione poisoning. The specific pesticide was parathione. And then that's why people who ate the bread were at greater risk of getting sick. Now, you could ask, well, if that's in fact what happened, how can there be cases who are classified as not having eaten the bread? This is something we talk about a lot in my outbreak investigation course, but almost certainly, in fact, these people simply were misclassified as not having eaten the bread when they, in fact, did eat the bread. Okay? Bad information, if you will, because if somebody is dead, how do you collect information about what they ate and didn't eat, and how accurate is that information? Okay? Now, the other way people could have figured out that the source of this outbreak was the bread was the leftover bread had been fed to ducks who also keeled over dead relatively soon after eating the bread, but that's sort of a different type of observation. Here's another case-control study of an outbreak of gastroenteritis due to Campylobacter jejuni in London. Campylobacter is a very common source of foodborne illness. So individuals had a positive culture for Campylobacter. They had 29. For controls, they took individuals living in the same neighborhood with no signs or symptoms of gastroenteritis, and then they asked them about many, many food items. And in fact, what turned out to be relevant to this outbreak was if you had milk delivered to your doorstep. Anybody here still have milk delivered to their doorstep? So this is sort of a 1950s thing in the United States. When I was a kid growing up, we had a milkman who brought milk and put it on the doorstep. Okay. And so that was associated with an odds ratio of around 6.5. And if your bottle of milk was attacked by birds, so why would birds attack your bottle of milk? These are crows, and they basically would take the nice little aluminum foil top off the milk and drink the milk, or the cream at the top, because this is unhomogenized milk. Okay, so they were after the milk, the cream, so they would drink the cream. So having a previous milk bottle attacked by birds, about 6.9, not taking protective measures against birds, an odds ratio of 51, drinking milk from an attacked bottle in the week before the illness, an odds ratio of 42. Okay, so all of this was due to these birds, these crows, basically drinking out of the milk and contaminating the milk in the process of doing it, right? Okay, so let's talk about a couple of other things here. So first of all, when the exposure is of interest is classified dichotomously. So dichotomous means you're exposed or you're not exposed. You're a smoker, a non-smoker. Okay, you're vaccinated, you're not vaccinated. Okay, then the overall measure of effect, the odds ratio, can be calculated. But if you have different levels of exposure, like quartiles of dietary intake of folic acid, or a continuous exposure, like grams of absorbency of a tampon, you can actually calculate the relationship between the level of exposure and the risk of outcome. What's the odds increase per gram, or what's the odds increase per quintile, or something like that. It depends on how the exposure is measured. So going back to those milk bottles, here you can see if you had no milk bottles attacked in the previous week, you're the reference group. 1 to 3 milk bottle attacks, you have an odds ratio of 51. 4 to 5 milk bottle attacks, an odds ratio of 70. 6 to 7, in other words, daily attacks on your milk bottles, an odds ratio of 140. Now, cancer epidemiologists typically get really excited about an odds ratio of about 1.5. But infectious disease epidemiologists get to have odds ratios of 140. So if you're not too bright, you might want to go into infectious disease epidemiology, because it's easier to find the answer if you're an infectious disease epidemiologist. Okay. So we're going to talk on Friday about use of case control studies to study vaccine effectiveness. But the basic notion here is we take people who have the disease, influenza or not, for example, we take controls, we figure out their prior vaccination history, we can calculate the odds ratio. 1 minus the odds ratio times 100% is the estimate of the vaccine effectiveness. Okay? So this is a study we did a number of years ago of a new infant immunization, a conjugate pneumococcal vaccine. So nationally, we collected cases. We chose controls, and I'll come back to how we chose controls. And then had how many doses of vaccine had they received? And then we can calculate the odds ratio associated with having had 1 dose, 2 doses, 3 doses, or 4 doses. And for each one, we can calculate an odds ratio and therefore a vaccine effectiveness. So 1 dose had a vaccine effectiveness of 76%. 2 to 4 doses had a vaccine effectiveness in this study of about 83%. Okay, pretty simple. You have to find the cases. You have to choose an appropriate control group. And then you have to figure out their immunization status, right? There are, in fact, many challenges to doing this and many problems in doing studies like this, as we'll talk about on Friday. Okay, so we'll just finish up with this study. This is a study looking at antibiotic use in breast cancer. So these are people working in an HMO, and so they were interested in whether taking antibiotics increased a woman's risk of developing breast cancer. And so they found 2,200 women with primary invasive breast cancer, and they selected female health plan members from their same health plan, matched on age and length of enrollment. So what's the advantage of doing this within this HMO setting? There are at least a couple of advantages, yeah?
All the records are right there.
What, the records in particular about?
The age of the people, when they got diagnosed.
Okay, yes, and what else? What else is presumably in the database? How many doses, what types of antibiotics they received when. Now, in theory, they could go off and get their antibiotics someplace else. But if you're an HMO member, you're pretty highly motivated to get your medications through your HMO because they provide them and you don't have to pay for them, right? So all the data about the exposure of interest are there. You don't have to ask women, did they take antibiotics? You have their whole exposure history for the time that they were members, okay? For the cases and for the controls, they ascertain the cases from the cancer registry, antibiotic use from the computerized pharmacy records. Okay? And so they can actually calculate the cumulative number of days of antibiotic use for these women. Okay? Not just antibiotics, yes or no, but number of days of use. Here are the controls, here are the cases, and then they can calculate an odds ratio for increasing number of days of antibiotic use. Okay? Pretty much doing all of it sitting in front of the computer screen. With all the HMO records that are already computerized. Okay. Now, is it possible some women took antibiotics that weren't in the database? It's possible. Is it possible some women were prescribed antibiotics and didn't take them? Possible. So, imperfect exposure data, but nevertheless. And you can see that the right way to analyze these data is calculate a P for trend and basically suggesting that increasing number of days of antibiotic use was associated with an increasing odds of breast cancer. Okay. This is a somewhat controversial finding, but they basically said that use of antibiotics associated with increased risk of incident and fatal breast cancer. Can't be determined whether antibiotic use is causally related to breast cancer. We'll come back to that later in the semester. And basically call for additional studies. But there's a great utility to doing these types of studies in HMO settings or places where all the data are basically in a computerized data set. Okay? So we're going to come back to a number of these issues in more detail on Wednesday.